I'm Christopher Light, and this is Open Source. The making of Van Morrison's Astral Weeks album is the story of a mystical document from the realm of the miraculous.
And I was strong and merry when I jumped the hedges first. And I will drink the clear, clean water for to quench my thirst.
Van Morrison was an impatient young Irishman on the loose in Boston and Cambridge 50 years ago. He had the full catalog of Irish tenors and black American blues singers in his head, John McCormick to Leadbelly. Then suddenly, in March 1968, he was live in a studio, not with a rock band at all, but with jazz session men who knew one another, but not their leader. Morrison had no tunes or harmonies written down, no instructions for his players, but then a cloud came along, said the recording engineer, and we all hopped on, and we landed when it was done. This is a cult classic, art being born or made when nobody knew quite what was happening. The story is wonderfully retold in book form with a Boston accent by the writer Ryan Walsh. Many others have felt pieces of it.
Astral Weeks literally took decades to become legendary. It's the ultimate slow burn.
I don't know what the heck it is. I don't know how to categorize what you can say about it. You know, something happened that was bigger than every musician individually and even as a group. I mean, no wonder this thing finally caught on.
Astral Weeks, insofar as it can be pinned down, is a record about people stunned by life, paralyzed by the enormity of what in one moment of vision they can comprehend.
And then the Van Morrison tape.
I mean, that comes from our imagination, is what they tell us, and that's where I think. Wherever our imagination comes from, then that's where it comes from. But I mean, Carl Jung said that it came from the collective unconscious, and I'll buy that.
Edna O'Brien, great lady of Irish fiction, says that Van Morrison's rugged, confrontational, ghostly voice in Astral Weeks speaks to me enduringly of love. Love is the crux of lost mankind. Our writer Ryan Walsh got hooked on Van Morrison's poetry, then his chords, then the puzzle of why he couldn't stop listening.
In 1968, Van Morrison, if you knew him, you would probably know him as the singer of a single on the radio, Brown Eyed Girl, that released in 67. But most people around here, when he ended up in Cambridge accidentally, didn't know who he was. And in fact, you might not realize who exactly he was till he played Brown Eyed Girl on stage. Even musicians who were playing with him, John Payne, flute player, recalls being on stage with him and then hearing Brown Eyed Girl and then saying, oh, I know who I'm playing with now.
Hey, where did we go? Days when the rains came down in the hollow, playing a new game.
If I'd seen that guy on the street and somebody said, you know, that's Van Morrison, what would I have seen?
Short Irish guy, longish hair, easy to get riled up about this or that, and probably would just keep his head down and keep walking past you. As a few people told me he did.
What was he doing here? Out of Ireland? Out of New York?
So, the record producer who produced Brown Eyed Girl, Burt Burns, in the 60s he got involved with some people who were involved with the mob.
Meaning, were they financing him?
Yeah, like he started, you know, or just hanging around. And then at a certain point, a guy working for Bang Records was named Carmine Wassel DeNoia. And, you know, he was considered by the FBI a low-level member of the mob. His father was the inspiration for Nicely and Guys and Dolls. And anyways, he's in charge of Van Morrison while he's in America. And in charge refers to everything from you know, smashing a guitar over his head and, according to Van, shooting bullet holes in his hotel door when he was out. So he's not only fleeing literal violence, but also trying to track down his art, I think.
How much of Astral Weeks did he have in his notebook or in his head when he got here?
Easily half of it, I think. Two or three of those songs certainly predate Boston. It seems like a lot of them were refined or partially written here. I think the title track, no one can quite date it, but I'm fairly certain that must have been written here if you look at when it first appears. And, you know, his wife, Janet, at the time, they had an apartment on Green Street in Cambridge. And he used to just sit in front of a tape recorder, stream of conscious, strum the guitar, and just let things come out of him. Hmm. She would then help him notate which parts sounded good and try to form these things into songs. Mm. He would just kind of zone out in front of a tape recorder for an hour, just belting out whatever came through him. I think he was desperately trying to restart his career. I think he felt he got off track. He was broke. Anyone who would let Van use their phone, he would call Eileen Burns, Burt Burns' widow, and argue about Brown Eyed Girl royalties. The money was not hitting him, and he, you know, desperately needed it. And he just started playing with various Boston musicians. He had at least three lineups of Boston musicians while he was here. He's only here about 6 months, but boy, is he busy.
Put us back in 68. A guy from Ireland is wandering around Cambridge looking for bandmates and ideas and opportunities. What does he find? What are the choices?
Well, in Harvard Square, you have the folk scene. It revolves around Club 47. Eric Von Schmidt, Bob Dylan played there, Joan Baez, Jackie Washington.
My old pal Jim Rooney, probably.
Absolutely. I think he was running the club at one point, right?
Probably.
But that scene was a bit on the decline. And then what you have on the other side of the city popping up are these, the first Rock Palace in Boston, and something called the Bosstown Sound, which is mostly a marketing term invented by record execs and involves all kinds of literal different sounds of kids forming bands and making records here in the city. So kind of a hodgepodge of things going on.
Even I knew to beware the sales DJs hawking the boss sound of Bosstown.
Right.
But what did Van Morrison hear in it?
On one hand, he probably wasn't inspired by it because he doesn't go in that direction, the psychedelic rock direction. But on the other hand, you know, he certainly was playing shows around here and sharing bills with some of these guys. And some of them do end up playing horns on Moon Dance, the next record, or being session musicians on his later albums. So a certain fondness for the players, maybe. But as far as the sound here, he was going in the other direction.
It's funny, people who come through Boston and do historic things. We've been fascinated with David Foster Wallace in a later day, living in Somerville, drying out in Alston, wandering everywhere, knew the place like the back of his hand. And he made a monument, a great immortal piece of work in Infinite Jest. Do we see Van Morrison as a precursor and a version of that?
I like to think about that idea because I'm so fond of Astor Weeks and Infinite Jest, and they're both made by non-Bostonians who come here, internalize the experience, whether it's 6 months or a couple years, and then somehow convert that into, in my opinion, kinds of masterpieces. And in Wallace's, he's name-checking Boston geography like there's no tomorrow. With Morrison, it's on the back poem of the sleeve of Astor Weeks. That was my first clue. Somehow, why is he name-checking Cambridge, Port, and Hyannis on the back of this classic album?
Back to Van Morrison himself, his family, his upbringing, the Irish rock scene as well as the Brit. Where was he coming from, so to speak? What's the Van Morrison origin story?
Van Morrison was an only child. His father, on a trip to America, brought home like a crate of American blues records that he became enamored with.
His father had taste.
Yeah, right. Van Morrison says he was writing poetry before he knew what poetry was. This idea of him as kind of a poet rocker, there's some validity there. And everyone says, including him, that it's the only thing he was born to do. His wife told me he couldn't make a cup of tea or tie his shoes. He just can create music. And that's all he's interested in doing as well.
Maybe to this day.
Yeah, I mean, even a later day record is called Born to Sing, No Plan B. And that's always been kind of his mantra.
What piece of Van Morrison was legend before Astor Weeks? When did the legend begin?
Astor Weeks literally took decades to become legendary. It's the ultimate slow burn. It didn't sell well. It was barely reviewed. It just kind of simmered there and passed from person to person. It was almost like every person who recommended it to another person is just as responsible for where it lands today, which is on every list of the top whatever of all time rock albums, 500, 100. It's always up there.
Let's talk about your version of maybe the greatest rock and roll album of all time. How so?
It doesn't sound like anything else. In that way, it's completely singular. It's evocative of a dream. Like, it's impossible. It's almost hard to see the edges and seams of the songs. In fact, some people call the whole album, the feel of it, as one long song. And there's just something about it that, when I first heard it in my early 20s, just really resonated with me. Just a beautiful poetry to it, and it's simple chord structures, but there's these fantastic jazz players, and they're not playing showy, they're supporting the songwriting, but it's, what they play is essential. And I just found it endlessly listenable, and sort of trying to figure out, every time I thought I knew what the album was about or what that title is about, kind of falls from your fingertips and the mystery deepens. And even after I finished this book, learning more about the album, you know, just filling my head with every detail, I still put it on, and it's kind of powerful and mysterious to me. All you gotta do
is ring the bell. Ryan Walsh subtitles his book in Astro Weeks, A Secret History of 1968. Step right up. Coming up, we're playing back the moment of Astro Weeks' creation with the flute and soprano sax man John Payne. And we're all getting chills and goosebumps after all the years. This is Open Source. The birth pangs of Van Morrison's Astro Weeks were heard first in the Ace recording studios just off Boston Common on Boylston Place, what was then a dark alley in the old theater district. Edgar Allan Poe of the Spooky Stories and the Raven Poem was born about a block away in the previous century. Ace's business was mostly commercial jingles, whatever came in the door. We went looking for traces of history with Ryan Walsh.
So the building we're in front of was where Ace Recording Studio was housed. It wasn't a famous recording studio in the sense of, oh, all these legends and great albums recorded. It was commercial jingles. It was bring in your poem and we'll make it into a song. And it was bugging people's cars and houses if you suspected your spouse of cheating. They had the equipment. So a weird place. It was run by two brothers, Herbert and Milton Yakis. I talked to the surviving brother. It was just another day to him when Van Morrison auditioned for Warner Brothers. Yeah, exactly. He was like, you know, when we closed down, I put most of the tapes in the dump. I took Armstrong playing trumpet. That apparently did happen here. And the initial recording of Charlie on the MBTA happened here. But it's not the mecca of where rock and roll happened, which to me makes it more special that this is where the producer of Astro Weeks came from New York, heard 30 seconds of the title track Astro Weeks, said he started vibrating and felt he was born again and Van was born again and he knew he had to make the record. According to him, they drove to New York that night.
Everyone always said that the Depression lasted in Boston until the mid-60s.
Right.
And Kevin White made it a sort of heady time. Interesting mayor, a lot of action.
Tried to relate to the young people, the counterculture, the best he could, right? It seems.
It was also time here and everywhere of black turmoil. And then at the time of the Martin Luther King assassination, there was this famous James Brown concert, which is in your book, right?
Exactly. How could they not cancel the concert, let it go on, but also keep the city calm? It became a real 11th hour nail biter.
Right.
Mayor White and James Brown literally backstage arguing over money. But the concert, by all accounts, was a kind of miracle. 68, with that concert and beyond, It just seemed like music was functioning as a kind of magic. Just truly being able to affect change instantly.
So the songs are deep fiction of a sort. Morrison called them short stories in music form.
The songs on Astral Weeks are lyrically timeless, and in that I mean that they're not referencing many contemporary things at all. There's a lot of gardens and fields. It's not newspaper songwriting like Woody Guthrie or Bob Dylan would do in his early career, in which you're singing the names, places, and literal conflicts of the day.
Mm.
It's devoid of that, but it must have been impactful to be an exile from your home in America, a stranger here in Boston, in a year that the country seemed hell-bent on ripping itself apart.
Even the perpetrators can't tell you just what made Astral Weeks.
The extended version didn't come out till a couple of years ago, and they released it on the re-release of with alternate takes of other things.
I thought I heard you here earlier.
There I am right there. Is that you right there? That's soprano sax.
That's John Payne, the reed man, who had just dropped out of Harvard in 1968 and has been a go-to player and teacher on the Boston music scene ever since.
Yeah, I was working right next to the Boston Common area. And lunch hour would come, and often I would go out with my flute, and there'd be some group of drummers somewhere or other in 1968, somewhere in the Boston Common playing, and I'd see if I could jam with them. Mm. I'd go back in, put my coat and tie on. And
you start with the day when somebody said, what are you doing this afternoon or tomorrow afternoon? How did it happen?
I was at a jam session at Lewis Wharf, and I was playing mostly saxophone. I barely played any flute, and this guy, Tom Kilbania, was playing bass.
Mm.
He said, I'm playing with this guy, Van Morrison. We're looking for a flute player. You should come down. We're going to go to Europe and make an album and all this stuff and come down and sit in with him. We're playing this place called The Catacombs in a couple of weeks or whatever. So I went, yeah, maybe I will. So The Catacombs, it was called. It was the basement below the basement. You'd had to go down a whole set of stairs, another whole set of stairs. Mm. I'd never heard the name Van Morrison before. And I walk in there, and there's about, I don't know, 30 or 40 people there. I see Tom Kilbane, and he recognizes me. This guy comes out who's short, has a page boy haircut. And Tom says, Van, this is the guy I was talking to you about. It's the flute player. And he kind of looks at me and gives me kind of a limp handshake. And he's just this guy in his own world. And I'm thinking, this guy's not looking for anybody. So they went up and played the first set. I didn't particularly like the first set. Mm-hmm. And then right before the beginning of the next set, Van came out, said, you want to sit in? I said, sure. So I got up on stage with him. And he started playing the guitar with Tom playing acoustic bass, and I listened for a while to see what was going on. This stuff is fairly simple chordally and almost never changes key. And I'm a good faker, pretty good at just hearing and how to fit in with something. So I waited a while and then I started playing with him, and I played my first notes on flute, and somehow I knew he heard me.
Mm.
And it might even be affecting how he's phrasing the lines that I'm playing. So I got the end of that first song and went, wow, that was great. That was something. And then the next song he started playing was Brown Eyed Girl. I'd heard the song a million times in this joint called Hazen's I used to eat lunch at in Harvard Square. This is the guy. So metaphorically, it's how far you can sink in the pop world so quickly. He's not just playing a basement club. He's playing the basement of a basement with 40 people listening to him. So I played the rest of that set. And Van asked me if I'd come back the next night. I came back the next night and played a couple of sets, and he asked me to join the band.
Do you remember all the songs? And were they all his songs? Or did you play any?
I don't know what they were. In fact, even after playing with him for weeks, he would just start playing with the bass player, and I'd listen a while, and then I'd start playing. He never told me what to play, how to play, when to come in, gave me any suggestion of any kind, or even what key it was in, but you know, it was pretty easy to figure that out in a couple of notes. So.
Mm. Speak about that little miracle, he heard you.
Yeah, you know, it sounds a little too crunchy canola. There's something cosmic about it. I mean, I felt him as a being. I felt he was big. I was in his space. And I had never felt that before with all the playing I'd done before. And he's hearing what I'm playing.
Who was this guy to you? This Irish guy in his 20s?
He was nothing to me, except he was the guy who sang Brown Eyed Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that I really liked playing with him. I'd never been a full-time professional musician. And so instead of going back to Harvard, which I was planning to do that fall, I said, screw that. You know, I'm going to New York. I'm going to Europe. I'm going to be on an album.
When did you first hear that we're going to record something here?
We went down to New York and we played live in various places for a few weeks. And then the hint was coming out that Tom and I weren't going to be on the album. We knew we weren't going to be on the album. But we went to the session, though. It sounded great. And the flute player was not a named flute player. In fact, people don't even know who he was. And I started telling the producer, Lou Marenstein, I can do this. I can play as well as he can. Mm. And it was driving me crazy not to be out there because Jay Berliner, the guitar player, Richard Davis, the bass player, and Warren Smith, I think his name was the Vives player, the grooves they were setting up and the things they were doing were so creative, and the way they were weaving in and out with each other and not jumping for the line at once. I mean, letting each other have space and stuff, and the flute player was doing that too. It was just miraculously intelligent and sensitive group improvisation. And then they kind of were wrapping up the session, and they said, well, maybe we should do one more. Lou Marenstein turned to me, let's let Payne play on it this time. What? But I didn't have a flute with me. So I went up to the flute player and asked him if I could borrow his flute. And the guy goes, oh man, I just want to go home. It was probably his third session of the day. It was a night session. All these guys did a lot of sessions.
Is that like asking to use his toothbrush when you ask if you can use his flute? I mean, it's rather intimate, personal property.
I didn't care what it was. I needed that flute, and I wasn't taking no for an answer, and I was bigger than he was. And he finally let me have his flute. We warmed up a little bit on the tune, and then we played it. And that was the last track of the first day, and it was Astral Weeks. Great line by Jay Berliner right here, right off the bat.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack.
Vibes, just one little note in the Vibes.
And the dead center back road stop.
There's the strings, overdub later.
Would you kiss my eyes, laying it down, silence easy to be born again.
Bluesy lines in the middle of this. And then my first note, here it comes.
From the five
there it was.
If I put the wheels in motion, and I stand with my arms behind me, and push another door, could you find me? Would you kiss my eyes?
Vives now playing a few more lines. I just played bup, 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 and then I repeat it.
Be born again. There you go.
And then Jay.
Standing with dun, the look dun, of Everest. I'm talking to Hugh the Ledbetter. Showing pictures on the wall.
And then I think I go, yeah, here. Ba ba da 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 da. I think that's Jay just playing rhythm guitar now for a while, not even playing any lines.
Taking care of your boy. I see another's got clean clothes.
There's two notes.
I see another's got clean clothes.
Then the strings come in.
I'm putting on his little red shoes.
And it's just cooking. The rhythm section is just cooking. There's no drums. It's just smoking.
Standing in your side rest.
And van is just like, I'm getting chills now. I'm getting goosebumps. Looking straight at you. What kind of music is this? You can't categorize it. Coming through, darling. And the bass player just going, and he can play a million notes if he wants to. But he knows he's part of the team. Between the viaducts of your dream, where a mobile steel rims crack and the ditch in the back road stop, could you find me? Would you kiss my eyes? And then the vibes is now for the first time playing a little fuller. Jay's got a great line right there. Whoa, that was incredible, that line. To be born again. To be born again. To be born again, to be born again, to be born again. To be born again. And all quieting down now. You've quieted down again. No one said nothing to nobody but what to do. In another world, darling. In another world, in another time. Then I go, got a home on high. Ain't nothing but a stranger in this world. I'm nothing but a stranger in this world. I got a home on high. In another land. And then the strings, beautifully, the strings, ascending strings. So far away. So far. And then they're playing in unison, and then one group leaves, harmony. One's staying in the high note, the other one's going down. And he's saying, way up in heaven, way up in heaven, and it sounds like heaven. Listen to this. They suddenly go into 3-4. 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. They're playing 3-4 against the 4-4. Out of nowhere. How do they think of that?
Brahms.
That's amazing. The strings are just unison, octave unisons. Not overdone. And another time. And then Jay plays this great lick. And then the vibes player is going to let up the dampers on his vibes. My God, that's amazing. I don't know what the heck it is. I don't know how to categorize what you can say about it. You know, something happened that was bigger than every musician individually and even as a group. Something just, I mean, no wonder this thing finally caught on.
You can compare it to a symphony orchestra, which is all written out and can be brilliant, but what can you compare this to?
That's what I'm realizing listening to it this time. It's not a rock album, it's a rock singer, and everyone else is jazzers, but it's beyond jazz. It's improvised, and that part of it's jazz, but these guys, this is not how these guys usually play.
I'm also thinking, John, where else in life do men or women make this sort of communal leap? It's sort of like explorers going this way, that way. I'll see you in San Francisco in 2 weeks. We'll get to the tonic chord again.
Yeah.
And there they are.
That's what was happening in there. It was a conversation. That's the perfect word for it. that's why Eleanor Jacquet described the bassy rhythm section, and he said it was a conversation. And I said, God, if we only knew what they were saying. He said, we know exactly what they were saying. And I said, like? He said, it was just love, man. Oh, it was love right. of that moment, love right. of the music, love of each that's other, right. love in the moment.
Right. And the other thing, this time I was hearing Van, I'm realizing how incredible his singing is on that. The depth of emotion that's coming up is like, oh my God, no wonder we were inspired. How much of the inspiration was just Van? And how much was the other musicians? I mean, who knows? It's like it came through him. And I think that there's an extent to which you can say that what happened in that track of Astral Weeks and the whole album was musicians channeling something. Mm. You can call it your higher self. You can call it God. You can call it anything you want. But whatever it is, it feels like it's flowing through me, not coming from me. And there's a sense in which I'm doing it, but there's another sense in which I'm just a spectator watching it happen. And the more I'm a spectator watching it happen, the better I'm playing.
John Payne has been a leader and a sideman on scores of bands in Boston with Bonnie Raitt and Phoebe Snow and many more. That's his John Payne Music Center you see from the Green Line stop at Brookline Village, where he is still teaching the rising generation of horn players. Coming up from Ireland and the future perhaps, a long view of what Van Morrison means. This is Open Source. Van Morrison helped rock journalism grow beyond fanzines, and a fresh crop of rock critics went to school on Astral Weeks. The late Lester Bangs was a champion of underdogs in the music market. He established himself as the soul of rock criticism with an essay on Van Morrison that sounds a bit like Harold Bloom on Shakespeare. The actor Eric Jensen, who played Lester Bangs in a one-man show off Broadway called How to Be a Rock Critic, gave us the force of Bangs' appreciation.
Astral Weeks would be the subject of this piece, i.e. the rock record with the most significance in my life so far, no matter how I'd been feeling when it came out. But in the condition I was in, it assumed at the time the quality of a beacon, a light on the far-off shores of the murk. What's more, it was proof there was something left to express artistically besides nihilism and destruction. It sounded like the man who made Astral Weeks was in terrible pain, pain most of Van Morrison's previous works had only suggested. But like the later albums by the Velvet Underground, there was a redemptive element in the blackness, ultimate compassion for the suffering of others, and a swath of pure beauty and mystical awe that cut right through the heart of the work. Van Morrison is interested, obsessed with how much musical or verbal information he can compress into a small space, and almost conversely, how far he can spread one note, word, sound, or picture. He repeats certain phrases to extremes that from anybody else would seem ridiculous because he's waiting for a vision to unfold, trying as unobtrusively as possible to nudge it along. What this is all about is a whole set of verbal tics, although many are bodily as well, which are there for reason enough to go a long way towards defining his style. They're all over Astral Weeks, four rushed repeats of the phrases you breathe in, you breathe out, and you turn around and beside you. In Cypress Avenue, 12 way-up-ons, babies sung over 13 times in a row, sounding like someone running ecstatically downhill towards one's love. And the heartbreaking way he stretches one by one in the third verse. It's a great search, fueled by the belief that through these musical and mental processes, illumination is attainable. Or may, at least, be glimpsed. In a windy rain, darling, you came walking down when the sun
shone through the tree. I asked Brian Walsh, our new biographer of Astral Weeks, to place it again in the context of the 60s.
Well, I mean, it's in opposition to the sound of the day, in one sense, because there's no backwards guitars, there's no drenched in reverb. It's not the psychedelic sound that dominated the airwaves at that time. So in that sense, right there, it stands out from the rest of the crowd.
The archetypes of that, the other psychedelic sound of the 60s being
Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, what the Beatles were doing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think Astral Weeks and the White Album came out within a month of each other. And, you know, it's interesting when you say, you know, just a young person pouring their heart out. That's true, but they also sound a million years old. There's something about his delivery and the lyrics that betray the age he was at the time.
Dylan-esque in that sense.
Absolutely. And he's not the kind of gymnastic poetry of Dylan. It's simpler than that, but something in it, kind of baked into the songwriting, is some kind of indication that this guy has seen some stuff.
This guy has seen some stuff, meaning...
It's an old soul kind of thing. His wife said it wasn't about psychedelics for him. You know, he would drink to kind of wind down or turn off the intensity of what he feels. But it wasn't something you could point to in his life experience. It's, you know, what they might call the experience or the soul of a poet and what comes along with that.
Paul Muldoon grew up in the decade after Van Morrison on those same streets of Belfast that turn up in Astral Weeks.
I, for example, myself lived on Fitzroy Avenue, which is mentioned in Madame George. I lived in a rundown house, student accommodation, the kind of house where we had, in fact, a public health order served on us. But we knew, even as we lived there, that Fitzroy Avenue was famous because of Van Morrison. One of my favorite quotes from Oscar Wilde, there are so many, is that there were no sunsets before Turner. There were no fogs before Dickens. And in some profound sense, there wasn't quite a Belfast until Van Morrison. So he played that role in making the place, in some profound sense, come alive, though, of course, it was coming alive in other ways. 1968, 69, the era of this album, those were the years when Belfast was getting quite hot in terms of the political upheaval. There was a lot of action on the streets. I mean, that was the beginning of what we refer to as the Troubles, as you know.
Paul Muldoon, what does a poet, Irish poet, make of Van Morrison's lyrics, which are powerful even when you don't quite grasp them?
Well, I think, you know, Van Morrison started out as a poet. He thinks of himself as a poet. He's published recently a book of poems that are indistinguishable in most cases from his song lyrics. So he belongs in that sense to the same tradition as Leonard Cohen, poem and song lyric, though they don't necessarily have to do the same thing, coinciding, coalescing.
What are your favorite lyrics in Astral Weeks or favorite tunes?
The single best song, I think, is Madame George. That's the one that resonates mostly with me, though, as I say, I dread to think of how much time I've spent listening to that album. Conceivably years. So the best of his songs, including Madame George, he's got a great gift for presenting a scene and summoning up a vision of a place. And then from outside the frosty window raps, she jumps up and says, "Lord have mercy, I think it's the cops," and immediately drops everything she got down into the street below. And you know you got to go on that train from Dublin up to Sandy Row, throwing pennies at the bridges down below, and the rain, hail, sleet, and snow. So even a detail of throwing the pennies at the bridges is the kind of thing that rings true of the place and, you know, the kind of thing the kids get up to around the place. And one of the features of Irish song is the use of internal rhyme. We see it even in "And Then From Outside the Frosty Window Raps, She Jumps Up and Says, Lord of Mercy, I Think It's the Cops," and immediately drops everything she got down into the street below. So he's interested in engineering. And that, of course, is a large part of what making any kind of verbal construct, be it a song or a poem, is about. You know, as with any work of art, there's a huge amount of hinterland you know, there's a lot going on in the background, a lot that is invisible and mysterious. Often, indeed, it's invisible and mysterious to the person through whom it's made. And I think Van Morrison falls into that category. I suspect he'd be happy to think of himself as been described as a medium. The sense that the song is coming into being through the singer, in this case himself.
Paul Muldoon teaches these days at Princeton. Back to Ryan Walsh, I asked him, who's the self in these songs, the author of this album?
It's shared. And it's interesting that Morrison is kind of particular about credit at times, when he himself sometimes cites his songwriting as coming through him, not authored by him, just kind of channeling something from elsewhere. Van Morrison's name is on the record, so that's the easy answer for authorship. But what I learned from writing this book was that it's a million little pieces, some planned, some accidental. So much of it seems like chance to me, when those fragments are all going to come click together and make something not only beautiful, but really stand the test of time.
Speak of the afterlife of Van Morrison himself. He's still among us.
Yes, he's put out two records this year. He's busy. Plays a lot of shows, tours. It's different now. It's not the sound of Astor Weeks. It's not often the songs from Astor Weeks. Oftentimes there's a lot of blues and jazz standards that he enjoys singing.
Hmm.
And then he'll do, maybe Moon Dance for an encore or something. For me, Van Morrison is most interesting on this one record that I love. And then the next 6, 7, 8 years after it, a lot of interesting material is generated. And then it stops being interesting to me. It's amazing he was in the pocket for those years and that he generated these songs. I mean, how many great songs or albums does anyone owe the world? Probably none. You know, so it's a kind of a miracle when you make one song that just lifts people's hearts. So the album ends with Slim Slow Slider. It's a tongue twister. Producer Louis Marenstein, he really had a vision for how this album was going to be organized. You know, for instance, he said the song Moon Dance was on the table. It was written. He could have put it on that album. He said it didn't feel right. So as they're making this record in the studio, he knew he needed some kind of ending, and they didn't have it yet. And Morrison had that binder that Janet had collated of all the stream of consciousness songs fragments he had made in Cambridge, and he just flipped through it, and finally they came upon Slim Slow Slider. Louis Marenstein, the producer, pulled a couple of the musicians out of the room, so it was sparser, and John Payne appears on it, and he says, you know, it's a mournful song, sad song. There's death. The first opening track of the album has that born again lyrical content. This has the dying. So it's almost like the whole album is this loop, the cycle of life. John Payne says when they finished their Take a Slim Slow Slider, they went into the control room, and previous takes when you would go in the control room, everyone, oh, wow, that was great, jubilant, happy. It was almost like a mournful funeral feeling. Maybe because they knew they had finished the album, maybe because the song is so sad. But again, it's an accident or not planned that this was ever going to finish the album. And it's a perfect ending to the album.
I don't think we'd ever played this live either.
Slim, slow, slider. Horsey ride in white as snow.
John Payne was playing soprano saxophone on that recording of Slim Slow Slider. 50 years later, he's listening back with us.
So this is just Van on guitar and singing with the bass player. And I haven't come in yet, but I'm about to.
Tell it everywhere you go.
And here's the first. And he goes, in the middle of the lick, actually.
Saw you walking down by the
morning. Saw you walking down by that brook grove this morning. Catching pebbles for some sandy beach. You're out of reach. Saw you early this morning. With your brand new boy and your Cadillac.
And he's going to talk about dying in a minute. It's interesting because if you flip the record over in those days, you get about being born again.
Saw you early this morning with your brand new boy and your Cadillac. You're gone for something. And I know you won't be back. I know you're dying, baby. And I know you know it too. I know you're dying. And I know. You know it too.
And Splice coming up. Here comes the Splice.
Every time I see you,
he says, know what to do.
I just don't know what to do.
And then Van. Sounds like a different, three different lines running around, like a fugue. I never heard him before or since ever improvise on a guitar, but he is in there. And then I'm doing that just to get a little space so the bass player can play. And then Van starts singing a Christian hymn at the end of it. Get the last note in the album.
And John Payne gets to play the last notes on our show, too.
I mean, I'm not usually a big fan of fooling around too much with the sound of a saxophone, but the engineer, Brooks Arthur, put an echo, reverb or echo, and whatever he did, he got that great sound. When I heard it, I just got a picture in my mind of someone playing an instrument on the other side of a lake. And I don't usually get pictures of things like that, but just that's what it sounded like to me.
Thank you, John Payne. Ryan Walsh's book is Astral Weeks, The Secret History of 1968. Thanks also to Paul Muldoon, Eric Jensen as Lester Bangs, Jessica Blank, Don Law, and Greil Marcus. Our show is produced by the Van Morrison Fan Club, all of us, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Becca DiGregorio, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our recording engineer. Mary McGrath conducts our group improvisation. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.